From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the sacred and the profane, Mavis Staples, best known as a gospel singer with her family's group, the Staples Singers, has a new solo album produced by rock star Prince. Mavis Staples talks with us about this unusual pairing and looks back on her work with her family. Also today, Israeli novelist and concentration camp survivor Aaron Appelfeld discusses the theme of all of his books, 150 Years of Jewish Loneliness. Performance artist John O'Keefe does an excerpt from Shimmer, his exploration of his early years in a youth detention center. And commentator Maureen Corrigan reviews If the River Was Whiskey, a new collection of short stories by T. Caragas and Boyle. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Ever since she was a teenager, Mavis Staples has performed with her family in the Staples Singers. The quartet was led by her father, Pop Staples, and over the years has included her brother and two of her sisters. By the late 50s, the Staples Singers are one of the most popular gospel groups in the country, and in the early 70s, they crossed over to the top of the pop charts with message songs like Respect Yourself and I'll Take You There. One of Mavis Staples' many fans is Prince, the rock funk singer-songwriter and producer. In 1987, he asked Mavis Staples to record an album for his label. It led to her new album on Warner Brothers. It's produced by Prince and co-produced by Al Bell, who made many of the Staples Singers' records on Stax in the 70s. Many people are surprised at the pairing of Prince and Mavis Staples. After all, she's best known for gospel music, and he writes lyrics which are controversial because of their sexual allusions. This is only the fifth solo album she's ever recorded. Most of the songs were written by Prince. The title song, Time Waits for No One, was co-written by Prince and Mavis Staples.
You came to me, said give you more time. Time to get yourself together. Time to make up your mind. I want forever love. You want a one-night fantasy. While I'm sitting here waiting on you, you know somebody somewhere is waiting on me. Time waits for no one. If you wait too long, you turn around and I'll be gone, gone, gone.
Mavis Staples, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry. It's a pleasure to be here.
The song we just heard, Time Waits for No One, was co-written by you and Prince. How did you co-write it?
Well, actually, I had written the song a few years ago, and Prince, as we were talking, he mentioned, well, Mavis, I want to know what's on your mind. I'd like to hear some of the songs that you've written. And I had a melody that was actually not quite up to par. And Prince reconstructed the melody. In fact, he did freshen it up with a couple of lyrics, too. So we actually did that long distance.
Mm-hmm. Prince's real sexy lyrics are about as far as you can get from sanctified music or message songs. Were you at all cautious about getting involved with working with him?
No, you know, I've been asked questions about Mavis. What are you doing working with this guy who writes these dirty lyrics? But for some reason, Terry, Prince's lyrics got past me. The dirty lyrics I didn't hear, you know? If you think about it, you really don't know what Prince is saying a lot of times unless you're reading it. And my main love for Prince was his music, period. So now when his manager spoke to me and said that Prince wanted me on Paisley Park and he wanted to produce and write songs for me, I did ask him what type of songs would he write for me. But it wasn't because of his dirty lyrics, it was the things that I heard on Vanity and Apollonia, you know. And I told him, I said, well, you know, I'm a grown woman, and I need some songs with substance. I felt like those were teeny bopper songs to me, mm-hmm. you know. And he said, Prince, he would be writing adult songs for me with a contemporary background. And that was all I needed.
Well, I want to play an example of that. This is a song written by Prince for you, I presume. Interesting? It was written for you?
Yes.
And this record really gets the full Prince treatment.
Yes, indeed. and he brought out a lot of Mavis's other personality, too.
Oh, like what?
Like Slick. You know, if you listen to Interesting, you know, I'm being real slick in there. And I'm actually flirting with this guy.
Uh-huh.
You know, because he walks in and I said, the song starts out with, like a bad politician. You know, you walked into the room and you're checking out. I mean, the lyrics tell it all, Terry.
Okay, let's give it a listen. This is an excerpt of Interesting from Mavis Staples' new album, Time Waits for No One, which was produced by Prince. And this is one of the songs he wrote.
Interesting.
Mavis Staples from her new album, Time Waits for No One. What was your family's reaction when you were young to singing secular songs?
That was a no-no. That was a no-no. In fact, Terry, I got the worst switching of my life for singing a blues song. And I was a kid in school. I was going to school down south at that time in Mount Bayo, Mississippi. And on a variety show, you'd hear Ella Johnson on the jukeboxes, you know, Since I Fell for You. And that song, just I liked it, and I would sing it to myself all the time. So doing a variety show, I knew I wanted to sing, and that song was the song that I was singing at the time. And I actually, my grandmother heard about it, and she gave me this nice little switching for it and let me know that, you know, no one had ever said to me, Mavis, don't sing the blues. Mavis, sing gospel songs only. So this was when I found out that, you know, my family was this, and I still didn't know because I was a kid, you know. But that was the first beginning of Mavis knowing that the Staples family would sing gospel.
Now, your father used to play blues before turning to gospel.
He did. Yes, but mostly just around the house or whatever, not actually on stage. Pops was inspired by guys like John Lemon, Blind John Lemon, and Harlan Wolf. You know, so when he first started playing his guitar, that was what he was playing. If you notice, you hear a lot of blues licks in the Staples Singers gospel songs, especially the first things that the first albums that we recorded. Because we had only Pops' guitar. That was the only music we had with us, and maybe a drum beat. But Pops still plays a very bluesy guitar.
It's an electric guitar, too. Is that unusual on the gospel circuit at the time?
Well, it was at that time. In fact, there were no guitars on stage, period.
Was that considered a more devilish instrument?
It certainly was. It certainly was. And Pops had to go to the Bible and let them know. You know, and in fact, I can't quote the exact scripture, Terry, but there is a scripture that it says, we shall rejoice with strings and tambourines. So you have a guitar instrument is a string. And shortly after, you know, when the church people seemed to have gotten past it, shortly afterwards, every gospel a singer on the road brought in a guitar, an electric guitar. Pops's was still different, though. He had this tremolo on his, you know, and they would call his a nervous guitar. And so, but like I said, shortly after the Staple Singers came with Pops playing his guitar, every group, the Dixie Hummingbirds, the Nightingales, Mighty Clouds of Joy, any group, gospel group that you could name, hired a guitar player.
Well, why don't we hear something from the Staples family?
Okay.
And you're singing lead on this.
Okay.
This is I'm Leaning. Staples family with Mavis Staples singing lead. You know, listening to you sing, you can't help but think you could have been Aretha Franklin, if you know what I mean. You could have had a lot of that kind of success as a soul singer.
Yes.
Now, you have had lots and lots of success.
Yes.
But did you ever wish that you were singing secular songs and on top of the soul charts all the time, and with all of the fame and everything that comes to it attached with that particular kind of secular success?
No, Terry, I really haven't. I was always happy singing with the family. My head just didn't ever go towards the being a solo artist and being at the top like that. I've had offers when I was a teenager, when I was singing with the family, things like Uncloudy Days. In our first years, I'd been offered millions to record secular music. People like VJ Records made offers, and other labels that were out during that time. But it just didn't appeal to me, and I've never felt that I've lost anything by not doing that. I've always felt that, you know, singing with the family and singing the gospel songs was the best for Mavis. But when I started doing these things in 69 with Sax, this too was to just try myself to see just how this would go, and also to enhance what the family was doing. But I've never even dwelled on getting out there like that. Yeah.
Well, I want to talk with you more about your life and your music, but first we're going to take a short break. Mavis Staples is my guest, and I'm sure you know her work through the Staples Singers, and now she has a new solo record called Time Waits for No One, and it's produced by Prince. We'll be back after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Mavis Staples is my guest. Tell me how the family started singing together.
Well, we were kids. I guess I may have been about 6 years old. My mother worked nights, and my father worked days. During the day, my mother would keep us, and at night, Pops would keep us. So Daddy was singing with a quartet group at the time. And things weren't going with them. Things weren't going, you know, how you have six or seven guys together. During that time, it's hard for everybody to be, you know, on the same accord and thinking the same. So Pops just decided one night he quit. He couldn't go along with it anymore. And he came home, picked up his guitar, gave each one of us a part. You know, but we were just doing this really to amuse ourselves, Terry, while Pops was babysitting, I suppose. But it was never meant, we were never meant to venture out into making a career of singing.
Well, how did it become a career?
It became a career because we had an aunt, Aunt Katie, one of Daddy's sisters, lived with us. And she heard us rehearsing. She invited us to her church one Sunday. Well, we went out to sing at this church, and we knew one song. The people liked it so much, they clapped us back, and we had to sing that particular song over and over. So Pop said, well, we'll go home and learn some more songs. We recorded Unclouded Day on a small label called United. And that record, a total gospel record, sold a million, which was unlikely at that time, in 1956. And letters just came from everywhere. Pops, my sisters, my brothers were working. I was still in school. And we were just flooded with these. So Pops said, they thought about it, giving up their jobs and getting out on the road to cover. All of these people wanted to hear us and see us. So we just started, it took off from that particular song, Unclouded Day.
The Staples Singers were, of course, your family group. But not everybody in your family sang. For instance, your mother wasn't in the group.
No, my mother didn't sing. My mother was the typical housewife and mother. She stayed home and encouraged us. In fact, she was the wheel in the middle of the wheel, the backbone of the Staples Singers. She prayed for us and gave us our spiritual guidance and just kept the home environment for us when we did come off the road.
Do you think she ever felt left out?
No, no, no way, no. To hear, we would try to get my mom to go with us, Terry. She went to New York with us one time. She went several places, but she liked Las Vegas and she liked the Caribbean island. Anytime we were going there, Mom wanted to go. But any place, or if we worked at home, Chicago, she was always there to support us. But no, she my mother, and she knew she didn't have any. All of our singing abilities come from Pops. My mom could start singing one song, Precious Lord, and before she's finished with that, she sang about 10 songs in there. She'd give you a medley. and all out of tune.
When you were an older teenager, you were already on the road singing gospel with your family.
Yes.
Whereas a lot of your peers were not with their families, and let's face it, when you're a teenager, it's a time usually when people start coming of age sexually.
Oh yes,
and experimenting with various things.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever feel held back from that, being on the road with your father in a gospel group?
Uh-huh. No, I didn't, because I was doing what I enjoyed, and when I came home off the road, I hung with my friends. You know, I was the average teenager. I went to dances. And skating rinks, bowling, you know, the everything that, and I had my best friends. I had my boyfriend. I'd write during that time, we would only go out maybe 2 weeks at a time. After later years, it got heavier where we'd stay out months at a time. But during that time, we wouldn't stay out any longer than 2 weeks, maybe three. And when we came home, I did everything the average teenager would do. I had all the fun. I went to my prom. You know, I lived my full teenage life.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And years later, I felt that when I was ready to get married, I was 24 years old when I married. and for a while, let's say I stayed married for about 7 years. So I've had a full life. I singing gospel and being with my family. I've enjoyed every bit of it. My life has been full. I don't regret, you know, any parts of it.
Did you remarry after that first marriage?
No, I didn't. I had kind of a stormy divorce, and I think I cautioned me into getting married again.
You know what I find interesting about that? You're so associated with a family group,
mm-hmm.
and that you only were married a short time yourself. And
yes. Well, I think mine is because, you know, I was traveling. That had some to do with it. And we were young. My husband was young at that time. You know, he wasn't quite ready for me leaving home all the time and whatnot. You know, but I wasn't about to stop singing. He never encouraged me to stop singing. But young people in those days, that was a lot for him. You know, for me to be leaving town a lot. And then I kind of married out of the, totally, I think maybe out of the entertainment, for an entertainer to marry, I married a mortician.
Oh, really?
So that was really a mismatch, yes. And the first parts of it, the first years of it was nice. But it got to be a bit much, I think, with me leaving town a lot.
Mavis Staples is my guest. Would you describe the church that you grew up in?
I grew up in a Baptist church. Very lively, where, you know, as soon as the music started, I'd jump up and clap my hands. It was at Mount Eagle Baptist Church. Reverend C.J. Rogers was the pastor then. And I'm still in the same type of environment. I'm at Trinity United Church of Christ now, Reverend Jeremiah Wright. And it's not the sanctified church, but people rejoice in the same way. You know, we have a good time. It's always a good time church.
In the late 60s, I think it was, the Staple Singers started singing message songs, which
yes.
was a departure from the gospel music. How did you cross over into that?
Well, the message song, actually, we made two transitions. We made one transition first before that message. We went to protest songs. Our first thing was protest songs. That was during the time we were with Dr. King doing the movement. So we'd sing songs like March Up Freedom's Highway and Why Am I Treated So Bad? When Will We Be Paid for the Work We've Done? All right, after we felt that things had gotten a little better, not all the way together, for as far as we were concerned, as far as the black movement went. But after the protest songs, we looked around to see gangs. So we came with Respect Yourself. These are the message songs, Respect Yourself. Songs like this.
I want to play something from that period.
Okay.
And this is I'll Take You There, which was a big hit for
All right.
the Staple Singers. You want to say anything about it?
I'll Take You There? No, well, we did this in Muscle Shoals with the Muscle Shoals Alabama guys. Al Bell produced it and wrote it. And I think it's a great song.
Oh, I know a place. Ain't nobody crying. Ain't nobody worried. No. Ain't no smiling face.
The Staples singer singing I'll Take You There, Mavis Staples singing lead. Mavis Staples is my guest. She has a new album, by the way, which is called Time Waits for No One, and it was produced by Prince. Most of your message-oriented hits were on Stax Records, mm-hmm. and this is a record company that had a lot of soul singers in its roster, and went broke in 1975. What effect did that have on the family group?
Well, we felt bad about it. We felt that, this was another black company after Motown, and it certainly crushed us to see that it was lost. But we had to move on. In fact, we went with Warner Brothers after those days, but we certainly felt bad about it.
How often do the Staple Singers sing together now?
Oh, well, every now and then we get shows. We're not getting a whole lot of work, but I'd say we work together, I'd say, about 3 or 4 times a month. And they are mostly European tours.
So does this mean that it's hard to find dates in America for gospel music?
Well, you know, Terry, the Staples haven't... a lot of times people have a tendency to think that if you're not recording, that you can't sing anymore, mm-hmm. you know. So people don't book you as much as they would if you had a hit record or if you were on the radio every day. See, so we haven't recorded for the last 10 years. And we get work in the States, but not a whole lot, you know.
One last question. On the album jacket for your new album, Time mm-hmm. Waits for No One, the one produced by Prince?
Yes.
It's a fairly sexy cover, you know?
Yeah. Yes.
Are you comfortable with
and
that
I'm
image?
And I'm still sexy, too.
Yeah, I know. Well, I'm just wondering if you're comfortable with presenting that kind of sexy image.
Oh, yes, yes. That's a part of me.
Okay.
You know, people have a tendency to think that you sing gospel songs and you're an evangelist. You know, or you wear a robe all the time and you walk around with a halo. But no, I'm a woman. And I try to show myself as a woman as much as the next woman. You know, so like I say, you're going to see a lot more of Mavis's personality. There are a lot of little Mavises off in here, you know. And in this album, Prince is letting it be, no, he grabbed a whole lot of them, you know. A lot of those Mavis personalities that the world hasn't seen.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your music and your life. Thank you.
It was my pleasure, Terry.
Mavis Staples' new album, Time Waits for No One, is on Warner Brothers Records. It's produced by Prince, who also wrote some of the songs. You can also hear Mavis Staples on gospel and message music records with her family, the Staple Singers. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with writer Barry Lopez. In his books Arctic Dreams and Of Wolves and Men, he explores wildlife and wilderness and their effects on the human imagination. I hope you can join us. Here's more from Mavis Staples' new album. This is I Guess I'm Crazy.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Aaron Appelfeld escaped from a concentration camp when he was 8. After the war ended, he joined the Russian army, then trekked throughout Europe before ending up in Israel. Today, he's one of Israel's leading writers. His novels reflect on the Holocaust and its aftermath. Coming up, Aaron Appelfeld talks about the loneliness of survival. Also, Maureen Carrigan reviews T. Karagason Boyle's short story collection, If the River Was Whiskey. And John O'Keefe performs an excerpt from Shimmer, his one-man show that explores his early years in an Iowa youth detention center. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Michael Richards. In Beijing, a military force in the thousands has moved against student demonstrators occupying central Tiananmen Square. The pro-democracy demonstrators, though, remain in defiance of martial law and government orders to leave. NPR's Vicky O'Hara reports.
The soldiers began moving toward the square about 1 a.m. They apparently hoped to take the students by surprise, as the troops were not dressed in full uniform. Local residents, who have been expecting such an attack for the past few weeks, sounded the alarm. People poured into the street, blocking the soldiers' path. The soldiers did not carry guns, but eyewitnesses said the troops were armed with axe handles and knives. There was a brief skirmish, and the troops retreated. They were forced to move away from the square through a gauntlet of angry civilians. The people lectured the soldiers for trying to move the students and for doing it out of uniform. One pedestrian is said to have been killed and 3 injured when they were struck by a military vehicle just west of downtown. Residents are promising a big demonstration in a few hours. In Beijing, this is Vicky O'Hara.
Soviet Foreign Minister Eduard Shevardnadze today described President Bush's latest arms control proposal as serious and constructive. But he pointed out that 100,000 troops of other NATO powers on West German territory are not included in the conventional force reduction plan. Shevardnadze noted that NATO and the Warsaw Pact now agree on tanks and armored vehicles, and their suggestions for limits on artillery and combat helicopters are very close. President Bush returned to the U.S. today from his talks with NATO leaders in Europe. He said that his meetings have led to a great and historic opportunity to transform the political and military landscape in Europe. Dissident Soviet physicist Andrei Sakharov was roundly criticized today by fellow members of the new Soviet Congress of People's Deputies for comments he made yesterday to a Canadian journalist about the Soviet war in Afghanistan. The BBC's Ben Brown reports from Moscow.
It was a sustained and venomous attack on Dr. Sakharov, and it began with a speech by a veteran of the Afghan war who lost both legs in the fighting. He accused Dr. Sakharov of slandering Soviet soldiers with his allegation earlier this year that troops in helicopters had opened fire on their own men to stop them being taken prisoner. Such an allegation was irresponsible and provocative, said the veteran, and his speech won a standing ovation from the deputies, including President Gorbachev himself. When Dr. Sakharov tried to defend himself from the podium, he was jeered and heckled. The war had been a criminal adventure, he said, and no one had the right to accuse him of telling lies because his allegations were still being investigated. But few deputies appeared to be listening, and Dr. Sakharov was forced to give way to a stream of speakers who accused him of insulting the army.
Ben Brown in Moscow. In Poland, Solidarity leader Lech Walesa was on the hustings today, appealing for votes in Sunday's partially free election. The ruling Communist Party made campaign pleas of its own, saying that opposition's success in Sunday's election could raise the specter of social unrest. The Southwest Bank of St. Louis today announced it's cutting its prime lending rate by half a point to 11%, although none of the leading New York banks immediately followed their example. Most economists expect them to lower their prime rates, though, in the near future. Southwest Bank officials say the decision to cut its prime rate is based on a slowdown in economic activity and the rising dollar. The Labor Department reported a 0.1% drop in unemployment last month, but the growth in new jobs fell considerably, strengthening the conviction of some analysts that the economy is cooling. On Wall Street, stock prices rose to their highest level in more than a year and a half. The Dow rose more than 27 points to close at 2517.83. Advances led declines 3-1 on a volume of 217 million shares. This is NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The secret places of childhood is one of the subjects touched on by writer and actor John O'Keefe in his one-man show, Shimmer. O'Keefe has been touring the country with Shimmer and is with us today for our weekly performance spot to do a few excerpts. O'Keefe now lives in San Francisco, but he grew up in Iowa in the 50s in a broken home. He spent part of his adolescence as a ward of the state in what was known as a rural youth detention center. His experiences there were the wellspring for Shimmer. O'Keefe's persona in the play is Captain Spacey. There's also the lurking administrator, Mr. White, Teets Brewer, and the bully, Richard Matheson. But Spacey is lucky enough to find a buddy, a soulmate, Gary Welch, who leads him first to other worlds and later to other languages.
Penguins really live in the ice, below the water. So do seals. See, they dive into the water, and then they go down into the ice, and they go far enough that they get to this place where the ice is so cold, it ain't cold anymore. It gets hard instead, like super concrete, and it's smooth, totally smooth. But isn't it dark down there? Nope, there's light. Where does the light come from? I don't know, it's just there. Right. It's a blue-green glow. Oh, yeah. Like the blue-green you see sometimes up in the snow. Exactly, man, it leaks up there. Ah. Now, below the ice, you find all these places. The seals go down there? Yeah. Well, what do they do down there? Well, see, they do everything that we do, but they do it before we do it. See, we just do it, and then we act like we did it first. You mean that there are penguins and seals that look just like you and me, and they're in a home? Yeah, man, but the home's different down there, man. It's neat. You get to see girls and drive around. Wow. Are there people who ever gotten down there? Yeah, and they tried to bring things up with them. What kinds of things? Things they'd never seen before. Well, what happened? By the time they got something to the top, it had turned to water.
At a lot of codes. Morse code, semaphore, braille, the Greek alphabet, sign language. We even made up our own sign language. Teets Brewer. He got us signing to each other and made us teach it to him. He was real good at it. The only trouble was that he laughed a lot and he jumped around on the bed so that old man White caught us and made us hold pieces of paper to the wall for 2 hours. Well, Teets wasn't to be thwarted. He started making a code up just using his face. Pulling both eyebrows up meant one thing. Pulling them down meant something else. Lifting one meant something else yet. Smiling with both corners of the mouth. Smiling with the right side. Closing the left eyelid. Thrusting the lower jaw out. Sticking the front teeth over the lower lip. Pursing the lips. Wrinkling the nose. Crossing both eyes. Crossing one eye. It's a miracle we didn't get killed out there, but old Whitey didn't hear us laughing. Receiving the code.
Anybody who tunes in, see, they catch this wave, and it's talk, and they pass it on.
And we get it, right?
Right, but we don't know we got it. See, we just act like nothing's happened, like static on the radio. I mean, we just think that that's noise, but it's really talk, Spacey. We're just not smart enough to get it. I know what you mean, man. Like smoke coming off a cigarette. It's like smoke signals for really smart Indians. Exactly.
Well, who's sending the code?
Everything. What's it being sent to? To whatever signaling for it.
What's that, God?
Yeah, but a weird god, weirder than a jellyfish. You'd throw up if you saw it. Well, what would you call this code? I don't know. It's not just a code. It's a language. It's on the edge of things. Yeah, it shines. Yeah, it shimmers. That's it. What's it? That's the name of the code. Shimmers? No, man. Listen. Shimmer. 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 Yeah.
Writer and actor John O'Keefe, he'll be performing Shimmer in July and August at Second Stage in New York. This is Fresh Air. Appelfeld is an Israeli novelist who writes about the Holocaust and its aftermath. Appelfeld is a concentration camp survivor. Writer Philip Roth describes Appelfeld as having a voice that originates in a wounded consciousness, pitched somewhere between amnesia and memory, and that situates the fiction it narrates midway between parable and history. Appelfeld was just in New York, where he was awarded an honorary degree from Yeshiva University and received the National Jewish Book Award. Appelfeld's new novel, For Every Sin, is set just after World War II. A young man named Theo has been liberated from a concentration camp, and he's determined to walk back to his home hundreds of miles away. Along the way, he meets groups of survivors who have banded together, and he goes out of his way to avoid them. He confronts one of the survivors to ask, "Why are all these people crowded together?" And he gets the answer, "It's easier to be together." But Theo says, "That's just an illusion, a delusion." I asked Appelfeld which side makes more sense to him. Is there comfort in being with others who have suffered?
I'm dealing with Jewish history, Jewish fate, Jewish gathering, and Jewish trying to escape from this kind of gathering. Escape your fate. Run away from your tribe. And this is it's a very strong feeling. And both feelings are very strong. To be together, a very strong feeling. From the other side, to run away from it. And these are two very strong motives in Jewish life.
Did you go through a period ever of wanting to run away from Judaism?
You see, to run away, it's sometimes an inner matter, not only an external matter. Theo wants to convert. He's coming from a very assimilated home. But from the other side, he understands finally that he cannot run away. He's part of it. You cannot run away from your past. You cannot run away from your hands, from your legs, from your body. And you cannot run away from your soul.
You have some things in common with your main character, Theo. You grew up in a prosperous, assimilated family. And I think Yiddish was almost banned in your house, as it was in your character.
Yes, of course, of course. Yiddish was somewhere connected with Ostjuden, with tribe, with Jewish history, with Jewish faith. So don't speak about it. You know, leave it. Mm-hmm. Let us forget it. We belong to Europe.
Your character of Theo learns Yiddish in a concentration camp. Did you learn Yiddish there as well?
Yes, of course. Of course, my first World War, I've studied, you know, Yiddish was the common language in the concentration camp. The Jewish language. So we became, part of us became Jewish in the concentration camps. Our first lessons were in the concentration camps of Jewishness, Jewish behavior, Jewish philosophy, Jewish mystics. It was years, you know, of deep soul searching.
Did you comprehend being put in a camp for a religion that your family didn't practice?
This is the part of, you see, of the tragedy, of the Jewish tragedy. People wanted for years in Germany, in Austria, to run away. And they actually ran away. And then came times when you cannot more run away, and you are confronted with yourselves, with your past, with your present. And this, of course, is tragedy. Many fellows, German Jews, committed suicide because they could not stand this kind of paradox. East European Jews, you know, understood that a Jew is a bad matter and you should suffer. But for the German Jews, who considered themselves as the best Germans, it was really a tragedy.
How old were you when you escaped the camp, and how did you escape?
I was 8 years old, and I ran away in the night. It was a winter night, and I escaped to the forest, just wandering like a small animal from tree to tree. And then finally I found an elderly woman was living outside the village, and she somewhere adopted me. So I was working in her home. And then, because I understood very soon that it is dangerous to stay in the same place, so I was wandering from place to place, from peasant to peasant.
How did you find out the war was over?
The Russian army liberated us, and I joined the Russian army as a kitchen boy, wandering with the Russian army. It's a new war, of course. From Russia through Romania, through Bulgaria, through, and I came to Yugoslavia. We were a group of Jewish children, and we were working in the kitchen mainly, preparing food for the soldiers. So we were wandering for 2 years, and it was quite an experience. A big Russian drunken army. And we learned to drink vodka, smoke cigarettes, and to curse. It was, you know, a frightening army, because it was a Russian cavalry, a drunken Russian cavalry. And in moments, they were quite frightening.
What was an example of a frightening moment?
Just, you know, because the soldiers were, mainly in the evenings, very, very drunken, you see. So a drunken person is always somewhere a bit frightening.
Now, how did you get from the Russian army to Israel?
It was near Napoli. We met a group of Jewish soldiers, a Jewish brigade, and they adopted us. We have told them that we are Jewish, and they adopted us. So this was really even better.
And they took you to Israel?
And they sent us to Israel, yes. You know, there was all the waves of Jewish refugees with no homes, sleeping on the beaches, thousands of them. No one wanted them. They just escaped the camps in the forest. And so we went with, you know, small boats to Israel. And so I arrived in 1946 to Israel.
You met your father in Israel, didn't you?
Yes.
He had your mother was killed, but your father survived the camps.
Yes, I've met him. I've left him when I was 8 years old and met him when I was 28 years old. So 20 years of separation.
How did you find him?
You know, I was looking. We have in Israel kind of offices who were searching for lost people. And suddenly I've seen his name. I was not sure. But finally I found him. He was working in an orchard. An elderly person with glasses, bald elderly man with glasses. He was in his 60s. And I've met him, yes. And it was beyond words.
Were you close after you met him again?
Yes, we became very good friends, yes, of course. Of course, we became very good friends. And I learned from him a lot because I left my home when I was 8 years old. And he helped me to reconstruct my past, to mourn more about him, about my family, about my grandparents, about the region where we are born, a particular region, an outstanding region, from the cultural point of view. And so through him, I became familiar with my past.
Getting your past back must have not only been important to you personally, but also as a writer.
Yes, you see, I came in a kind because I was in a vacuum. With no past, how can you be a writer? With no real memory, how can you be a writer? And my writing is mainly reconstructing my pieces of memory into a piece of fiction.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Aaron Appelfeld's new novel, For Every Sin, is published by Weidenfeld and Nicholson. This is Fresh Air. Let's check in with Linda Wertheimer and find out what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Terry. About 2 o'clock this morning in China, which would be 2 o'clock Saturday morning in China, troops began moving on Tiananmen Square. We'll hear from our correspondent in Beijing. Veterans of the Afghanistan wars denounced Andrei Sakharov today in the Congress of People's Deputies. We'll take a look at what we think all of this might mean. Elections in Poland, of course, are coming up this weekend. Polls in America can vote absentee. We'll have a piece from Chicago. And Noah Adams speaks to the biographer of the late pianist Glenn Gould, and we'll hear some of Gould's recordings.
Thanks, Linda. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. If the River Was Whiskey is a new collection of stories by T. Caragas and Boyle. Critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
Most postmodernist writers regard history as a subject to turn to when their imaginations stall. Fashionable fiction these days chronicles the inner life. At its most expansive, it tells the story of failed relationships between two, sometimes three people. This minimalist style doesn't require extensive research. Writers only need to peer into their own navels and scoop out the raw materials for their next book. Of course, a few contemporary writers like E.L. Doctorow, Marge Piercy, and Milan Kundera find the outside landscapes of history and politics just as fertile. T. Caragas and Boyle is the latest writer to join this perverse group. His spectacular 1987 novel, World's End, ranged over 300 years of Hudson River Valley history, jumbling together 17th century Dutch settlers, 1940s Peekskill anti-communists, and 1960s hippies. Now, in If the River Was Whiskey, Boyle tries to snatch the short story back from the minimalist postmodern crowd who've claimed it as their signature form. His attempt is noble, but doomed. Few short stories can convey the cumulative weight of history on characters' lives. And Boyle doesn't have the room here, as he did in World's End, to elaborate on the forces that slowly warp personalities into fantastic shapes. So the characters in most of these stories are simply ready-made eccentrics, an all-too-familiar type in postmodern fiction. Boyle only manages to allude to the lurking presence of history somewhere outside the tight confines of his stories. A young man in the story Modern Love gazes at his date and sees the long, elegant, mournful face of her Puritan ancestors. In the painful story Sinking House, a widow turns on all the faucets, toilets, and lawn sprinklers because she can't stand the silence of her empty house. Her last visitor was a college student researching an oral history project. Then there's The Devil and Irv Chernesky, a funny updating of the Sleepy Hollow legend. Here, the devil, dressed in a yellow power tie, confronts his latest victim in the primordial woods surrounding a housing development. As Boyle describes the place, the stockbrokers, lawyers, doctors, and software salesmen who live there with their families know the community as Beechwood, in deference to the legend hammered into the slab of pink marble at the entrance. This slab was erected by the developer, Sal Maggio, in the late 1960s, though there are few homeowners now who can remember back that far. For Boyle, the housing development symbolizes the charmed circle of historical ignorance that insulates most Americans and most contemporary American fiction. Boyle comments on that condition, but he only remedies it in the magnificent title story of the collection. If the River Was Whiskey describes the relationship between an alcoholic father and his protective son and illustrates how history, in the private forms of memory and a shared family past, determines personal destiny. This theme obsessed Boyle in World's End, and I hope he returns to it soon in a novel as overgrown and haunted by the past as the woods beyond Irv Chernesky's cramped suburban lot.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Bryn Mawr College and writes book reviews for The Village Voice. Here's a look at the next fresh air. Next time, I talk with dancer and choreographer Bella Lewitsky. She's considered one of the seminal figures in West Coast modern dance. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the complete Atlantic and EMI jazz recordings of Shorty Rogers. For many, Rogers is best known for big band recordings, but starting in 1955, he also recorded compositions with smaller groups, and those recordings are now gathered in one set. And television critic David Bianculli reviews two upcoming programs, Stephen Banks' Home Entertainment Center, a live Showtime comedy special, and HBO's Tales from the Crypt, an adaptation of the EC Comics horror series. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet. Production assistants from Lisa Bruton and Ed Doherty. Research assistants from Christopher Cook and Laura Civitz. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.